the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
Science is a vehicle for knowledge. We are always at the brink of the known.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them all suffering.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you. And that understanding empowers you.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
Welcome along to Redshift. You're here listening to Science and Music right here on 93.9 between now and 6.30 this afternoon. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you today. Tunnelling Art and Physics is a collaborative exchange between students from Fine Art in NCAD and the School of Physics in UCD. And we've got two of the people who are very involved in it in here to talk to us today about it. We'll be talking to artist Emer O'Boyle, who's a collaborative artist, and she's been working very closely with Lorraine Hanlon, who is the head of physics out in UCD. You're very welcome. Hello, how are you today?
Great, thanks for having me.
Excellent, yeah, it's delighted to have you here.
It's wonderful to have you both in studio. It's a real treat for us and for our listeners, I think. And with the backdrop of kind of the budget going on today, there's a lot of negative news, and I think it's wonderful to be able to bring some positive news to the airwaves of Dublin.
I totally agree. So tell us, how did Tunnelling Art and Physics come about?
Well, it all started back in 2010 when Lorraine was the head of the School of Physics then. Lorraine commissioned me to do a series of portraits of people that work in the School of Physics. And really, I was very interested in this human experience of scientific research. So it was the real sense of passionate curiosity of the scientists there that sparked this interest then in continuing the collaboration. And I proposed to Lorraine and to Philip Napier, the head of Fine Art, if they'd be interested in coming together, the two learning institutions coming together and bringing our students together to work in a collaborative way.
And so this has been running since 2010, or is that when you first met and did the portraits?
So yeah, we've run 2 years of tunnelling. It'll do its third year in January.
And so is it the same group of students that are working on the project, or is it each new year as they come along they get involved in a collaboration?
Yeah, it's every year students can elect to do this particular module. So we get students from sculpture, print, painting, and then it was physics up until this year, but now it's open to all science students in UCD.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's a fantastic array of people.
And can you tell us about some of the projects that you've worked on?
Yeah, wow, where will I begin? Let me think. There's one particular project I'm thinking of. It's by an MA student last year from NCAD called Sophie Losher and Rebecca Keown, who is a student of physics. And they were very interested in exploring this idea of equilibrium, where opposing states of conflict will end up balancing each other out. And they used, they did a lot of experimentation talking about the relationship between the studio and the laboratory and how we work in both. And they made an installation, a beautiful installation in Temple Bar Galleries there this year, where they used two huge weather balloons, one filled with argon gas, another filled with helium gas. And it was incredibly precise amount of work that went into balancing them out, so it was an installation, basically a very sort of an odd thing to come across. It looks impossible, mm-hmm. and yet there are two very large balloons floating in space, balancing each other out. So it's a way of for the viewers to come to kind of an understanding of this notion of different weights of gases in a very physical and real way.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. Yeah, and is that still in Temple Bar?
That was a temporary exhibition. It's not there now, but we hope to have an exhibition of Tunnelling Art and Science now each year.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And do you find, Lorraine, that combining art and science makes science more accessible to the general public, say?
I think so. I think one of the goals has been to open both our science and our Irish artists to new audiences. And I think when you look at the visitors book in Temple Bar Galleries for the week of the exhibition, we had hundreds and hundreds of people passing through the doors, seeing science in a completely new context and engaging with science in a beautifully visual way, an auditory way as well, which would never happen in the halls of a physics lab or a science block.
Yeah, I tend to picture the halls of physics lab as, you know, you might see some pictures of old physicists, old men with beards. I don't think of them as arty places.
And I think it's fantastic, really exciting time in UCD science because we have a whole new building going up at the moment, which is going to transform how we teach science, how students learn, how the public engage with science. And as part of that process, that's why we've expanded Tunnelling Art and Physics to all of science. So we'll have students, not just of physics, but biology, chemistry, mathematics, computer science, geology. Everyone can Wow. participate now in the module. And we've also expanded into a new artists in residence program in UCD Science, which Emer is curating. And we have four amazing Irish artists collaborating now with UCD researchers in science to develop new ideas, new ways of collaborating and new work.
It's a very fertile interface, I think. I mean, historically, when you look at great works of scientific literature like Micrographia or Principia Mathematica, there was artistry that went into the production of these as well. Rendering scientific concepts to other human minds requires an artistic inclination, I think. And I think it's wonderful to know that in Ireland at the moment we have a project that is harnessing our artistic creativity and melding it with science to invite more minds and expose the information to more minds as well. So yes, I find the project very enticing. When is your new building in UCD going to be finished? When are you moving in?
The lecture block is going to be hopefully finished by early next summer, and then the new research wing, which will house huge research centres in earth sciences and computer sciences, should be September next year. So very soon.
Quite soon. Mm. Excellent. And is the organisation of the space in any way influenced by the tunnelling project?
Ooh. In a sense, it already some of the ideas have obviously been in gestation for a few years. So there is exhibition space, for example, that we would hope to make use of. There is a new lecture theatre for outreach and public activities, so a dedicated theatre where events can take place that don't clash with the normal run of lectures in the academic programme. And there's labs where school kids or general public can come and do experiments with researchers as part of an outreach program. So there's a whole emphasis really on engaging with the community and engaging with the public, and certainly the tunnelling gives us another manifestation of that.
And it'll be really interesting to see what happens now with the new these artists in residence working so closely with the researchers in UCD, what kind of new work that they can come up with as well.
It's got off to a really positive start, and the artists, we had huge response from the artistic community in Ireland. It was very difficult to select people, but they had already some ideas of the kinds of projects that kind of areas of science that interested them, including neuroscience.
There was geology. Siobhan
geology, biodiversity and soil interactions, and physics. So they've already got started in talking to those scientists, but we're keeping it as well broad so that other scientists can talk to these guys and engage with them. And who knows what will come out of that too.
Excellent. Can I ask... I can understand the creative flow from the scientist to the artist. Can you tell me what the feedback is from scientists? How does that affect their work?
I think it's interesting because there's very much it becomes a collaboration. And, you know, sometimes we notice that the physics students kind of feel that they're, you know, the tech support for the artist, you know, get me a signal generator. And then they, you know, we kind of work hard to remove that notion that it's very much a collaboration, that they have technical know-how, the artists have skills in terms of actually making things and getting ideas on paper. And really the process is through experimentation of playing, essentially. And we start them off with a whole range of demonstration equipment in a room, lots of noise and mess and playing with level water levels in cylinders and making standing wave vibration patterns on plates and so on. And that actually was really the genesis of some of the ideas, at least, that ended up being in the exhibition. They stemmed out of that beginning process of experimentation. But really what impressed me with the physics students, because I would know them best, is the latent creativity that is there and has never been given an opportunity in the academic program to express itself. So there was a great blossoming, I think, of that. And it's very good for the students then to realize, actually, physics isn't everything. I like physics and it's a way of exploring the world, but this is a good way as well. And I think that's fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose the greatest experimental scientists are always ones that can tap into their own creativity as well. I mean, they're engines of hypotheses. And so being in contact with other creative people who see the world in a different way can be a catalyst for creativity amongst the scientific.
Exactly, and learning that, I think learning to have that conversation as well, having an open mind in a conversation is really important in the world out there.
Yeah, and certainly the most successful project, I think, so far, and we've talked about this, it's sort of evident that the success derives from this ability within the students to step away from their own ideas in one way and to let go of their own ideas and just to listen very carefully to the others and to allow new ways of thinking and new ways of doing things come in. So it's incredibly valuable. And then in terms of the creative expression of the physics students, it was really evident this year on the opening night of the exhibition, just the huge excitement, nerves and excitement about publicly displaying something like that. This isn't necessarily something that the physics students or scientists in general would be used to doing. And it's a very, very brave and courageous kind of thing to do. And the whole process of putting up an exhibition, the amount of work that goes into that, it was a hugely valuable experience that they all voiced.
Art and science are such different sides of the coin, left brain and right brain, or, you know, they seem so different. But I think when they come together, the creativity, there must be so much synergy that just explodes into new ideas. Do you think that the artists are learning more about science and kind of take away an interest in science when they're finished with the programme?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. I think we all have these ideas about each other, don't we? I mean, artist is a certain type of thing and scientist is a certain type of person. But actually, you know, when people actually come together in the same space and in through conversations, those sort of prejudices and ideas are obliterated and you can really connect then on the points of passion that we all share. And it's there, you know, they're the kind of starting points then for these fantastic project.
You're listening to Redshift right here on Dublin South FM 93.9. I think we're going to take a track in a couple of minutes, or right now actually, and we're going to start off with something. Lorraine was saying that her favourite band is one of my favourite bands, so if you listen to the show you already know what's coming. So I think we're going to have the Foo Fighters. Let me just check with Tony, who's in there engineering. Hi Tony.
Hello.
What's going on in there at the moment?
There's some Foo Fighters coming up.
I thought there might be.
Yeah, so.
Mic's up.
And we're back. And I'm sitting here with one of Ireland's top scientists, Lorraine Boyle, is that right?
Lorraine Hanlon.
And I'm sorry. And
Emer O'Boyle,
artist in residence, I suppose, in collaboration. And I'm very curious about the generative nature of this collaboration. So, Lorraine, one of the aspects of being a scientist is that you do have a role as an educator as well. And was consciousness of that role part of what informed your interest in this collaboration? And how do you think this collaboration affects the scientists that, such as yourself and the people you work with? How does it affect their role as educators?
Well, certainly I benefited enormously from collaborating with Emer. That was my first experience of working with an artist and having, you know, these very all-embracing, I suppose, or all-encompassing conversations and ideas and linking and making connections that reverberated for me professionally as well and touched on issues in teaching and education and communication of science that interest me hugely. And obviously my day job is an educator. I'm an academic. I teach. And it seemed very natural that, you know, when Emer suggested, could we make this kind of collaboration part of the curriculum? Could we really pass on this experience that has been so positive for both of us to our students? And that's why we tried it out. And I think it's fair to say that idea of being a listener, having an open mind, and being creative and allowing the space for such a process to happen in a curriculum that's really jam-packed for the students, in fairness. It's focused on assessment, it's focused on exams, assignments, reports, labs, homeworks.
Tight methodology.
Very tight and rigorous and so on. And this just wide open space of this module allows really a new dimension to their education and something that we certainly see is critical for scientists. I hope important for artists too, but critical for scientists to understand the place of their science in a bigger picture. And they learn that by working with the artists. Understand the issues around communication. They're now communicating their physics ideas through a medium that could be visual, painting, photography, sound, in a completely new way. So I think it's a real transformation in the learning experience.
Excellent. And Lorraine, Emer.
Yeah,
forgive my...
We're interchangeable. We call ourselves Lemur, by the way.
Excuse my short-term memory lapses. One of the roles of art is to hold up a mirror to the world, and I'd be curious to hear how you feel the interaction between the artists you teach and yourself and the scientists. How does that develop their worldview, and how does that develop how they reflect the world in the art that they produce?
Well, I mean, science has such a profound impact on so many aspects of society, political, medical, philosophical, social, the media-related conditions within which artists work. But it's often distant. We can often see artists excavating a body of knowledge from books. What I think is really, really valuable about coming together as human beings is that depth of experience and the depth of knowledge born of passion is what comes through. I think I've just lost the thread of your question, actually.
Well,
sorry.
One of the things that occurred to me is that, as Lorraine was saying, the methodology is very important to scientists, that it's critical that their methodology is very focused on ruling out mistakes and using experiment and observation to find out things. Whereas the working method of artists, my personal experience of the working method of artists, is it's much more organic, that people will develop their own methodology, whether it be mixing paints, whether it's audiovisual, whether it's a sculptor or a modeler. And I think one of the aspects of this collaboration that I find curious is when you have artists with this methodology working with scientists with this methodology, something must rub off on each other. Whereas I think the artists might find a part of the disciplined methodology inviting, because they can suddenly excel at a particular medium or form of expression. And the scientists are going to absorb some of the free associative creativity that artists bring to how they work. And I'm wondering how it affected you personally and in any way that you've seen in your students.
Wow, how it affected me personally. Well, actually, hugely. I found working with Lorraine and working with the scientists in UCD incredibly inspiring. In terms of what they can knowledge that they can actually generate through that disciplined methodology, and their grasp of the nature of reality and those fundamental laws that govern the nature of reality. I think there's a comfort, isn't there, in certainty?
Yes.
And that certainty can exist in science, while at the same time in art, I suppose we learn to be quite comfortable with uncertainty and to develop ideas through that. Actually, I'm finding the question quite difficult because I can't pinpoint an exact answer other than it was a really really very, very inspiring to be around people
your
with
art?
Such inquiry. Yeah. Actually, it has, in the sense that I'm making very little now.
Right.
So I suppose my art and my art practice now is about bringing people together, and it's about organising the tunnelling art and physics, creating these spaces for people to be able to collaborate and work together.
So it's actually how it's affected how you work is in how you interact with your students and how you facilitate their development within the tunnelling project, because you've seen the blossoming of creativity as a result of this. So
yeah, and this is definitely something I really want to support, and I believe in the value of supporting this and protecting this space within what we see now is very, very tight curriculums.
Right. That's absolutely excellent.
I'm very interested in certain aspects of the actual art that you've been creating. So I wanted to talk to you about, well, you and the other artists. There's a number of portraits that have been done. I wanted to talk to you first about the John Eaves one. Can you tell us a little bit about that one? Because I know it caused quite a controversy when it first appeared.
So, yes, John Eaves is a quantum physicist in UCD, was at the time. And we had... I had been talking to him about quantum mechanics and trying to come to terms with that incredibly complex world, the quantum world. And I decided that one of the ways we were talking about multi-universes and possibilities, and I decided that I would make a series of memorial cards to John. So this portrait is a photograph. There are three photographs side by side. The two on either end are taken within about a split second of each other. And there's one in the middle that I asked his mother gave me from when he was very young. And underneath these portraits or these photographs, there's a little John Eaves died on a particular date on the first two. And then on the third one, there's a piece of metallic tape over so we can't see the date. So I was... Yeah, thinking about this idea of certainty and uncertainty, and that death actually is something that I am certain of, that we're all certain of, but that we just don't know when. And the idea that, the multi-universe theory, for example, that we could be, in fact, long dead.
There could be another one of me out there somewhere.
Exactly. Not so fortunate to be sitting here this evening in this studio.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was ideas around that. But of course, they're sitting in the corridor as a memorial card to a colleague. So some people
went,
what the heck? I only saw John yesterday. This is tragic.
There's an interesting history of people who read their own obituaries while still alive. And it changed them. For example, the Nobel Prizes. Alfred Nobel was a notoriously miserly and unpleasant individual who'd made his money on owning monopolies for making matches throughout Europe and dynamite as well. And he was, when word got out that he died, he hadn't actually died, an obituary was written about how he was a warmonger and a hoarder and a very unpleasant man. And he read this and it changed him irrevocably. And that's why he set up the foundations for the Nobel Prizes. So I think you're touching off something there with your controversy.
Well, it was at this point, because I was the head of school who had commissioned these portraits, and it was at this point I thought, oh, uh-oh, my God. She's yes, killing off our students.
Here's a hot potato in my lap now. Yes, I remember Christopher Hitchens talked about how he read of himself as the late Christopher Hitchens, and he wrote his memoir as a result. These things can have profound effects on the individuals concerned, and I've only heard of good effects. So,
okay, so maybe he'll go on and win a Nobel Prize after that. Now,
he does.
And there are a number of other portraits that you've done. Did you choose? How did you choose the people to do the portraits of? I mean, I know you did one of Ronan McNulty, who's very much known to our listeners as a quantum physicist who's working out in CERN. He's back from his sabbatical there, and I think he's back in UCD now.
In Ronan's case, Ronan had just been celebrated with John Keaveney for the discovery of the W and Z particles. So that was a sort of an obvious kind of a person to begin to talk to, but an important part of the series of portraits was that I wanted to celebrate all of the people who allow the subject to develop and progress. So that includes technical staff, administrative staff, not just the guys like Ronan, for example,
who are
headline writers.
Yeah, who would have their portraits painted, and you'll find them in galleries. But the huge mix of people that allow from behind the scenes as well, but play a really important role in allowing this kind of discipline to progress.
Mm. One of the very lovely portraits is of the front office manager, Barbara Fox. And that's...
I've seen that one. That's lovely.
And this is so brilliant because Emer has captured really lots of different dimensions, if I might.
Oh, please do.
Talk about your work.
This is great. A scientist discussing art. I love it.
Well, I just loved it as a portrait, and it's Barbara's lovely hair with the Van de Graaff effect standing on end. But there's also, in front of that portrait, there's text written in pink script, which describes how a photocopier works. And only Barbara can read it because it's the right way for Barbara.
Nice.
And Emer wanted this to express the kind of privileged position that someone like Barbara has in a department, that she has access to lots of information that none of the rest of us mere mortals have, that she has this overview and really central role. And I thought that was a really beautiful example of the portraits that Emer did for us.
It is a gorgeous picture. In fact, presumably it's on a website. I know I've seen it on loads. Which website would be the best one to go to? It'd be the...
It's on UCD Science.
UCD.ie/science.
I think it's called The Art of Physics. If you Google The Art of Physics.
Oh, yes, yeah. UCD. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, there's a piece with video actually on it as well. It
suggests another question to me. When you're doing a portrait of an individual, whether it's an administrator who sits at the centre of an information network, so to speak, or a scientist who discovered the W boson, does their field of work influence your portrait of them?
Well, yes, absolutely. Well, I would hope that it would. And it's a kind of a process where it just begins with conversations. And actually, 90% of it is through conversations and getting to know the person. And then we work off points of resonances or points of shared interests. For example, Frank Heffernan is a technical support down...
in the mechanical workshop. He's a
mechanical
technician.
Terrific guy. Who is incredibly talented. And so I did a portrait of him. When I went into the workshops, I did a lot of work in the workshops with them. I was doing an installation of a quarter model satellite of the XMM Newton. But happened to be in the workshop a lot. And around, they were making these incredibly precise machines that allowed...
Some of which are used in CERN, some of the components that they make in the workshop. And you were amazed that... someone like Ronan or me or whatever would go in and have a pen and a cigarette pack or the equivalent and
scrappy
draw a little bit
yes.
of rubbish and put a coffee cup on it, and then they're expected to make this amazingly precise machine from it. So you gathered up a lot of that material.
You know, the truth behind the scenes, all of this sort of based in conversations and scraps of paper.
Right. Yeah.
And that was the basis for the portrait that Eimear made of Frank with all these pieces of paper.
So behind the portrait. One layer, it's all of the pieces of paper I found and scraps that I found in the workshop, and then on the outer layer of the perspex is a portrait of Frank made up of the word make work, make work, make work, make work.
Wow.
So it's a sort of a prayer of the scientists going into the workshop, please make this work. And then and Frank's work itself being a make. He physically fabricates
things.
So it was a sort of a play on those two. So yes, the answer I suppose is yes, the person's work really wanted to try and express that in each of the portraits.
But that's only one dimension, the person's personality and their method of work as well, because as you were saying, that you were astonished by the transformation of scribblings on napkins turning into high-precision machines.
Feynman's finest work came from scribblings on napkins.
But that's just when you said it, I thought to myself, yeah, that is truly astonishing, because when you look at an object like CERN, which is the largest scientific experiment ever conducted, and astonishingly precise, to think that it was generated out of somebody's mind through a pen onto a cigarette box or a napkin is quite astonishing.
I know, I'm sure not all of it was made like that.
Elements of it must have been, though.
Well, and I think that's what's so beautiful about coming together with scientists, is that it's really a human endeavour.
Yes.
And it happens in everyday life. It's not this abstract world
ivory tower,
yes. No, it's not. And it comes through human beings, through human emotions, through human conversations and interactions. And that's what's so beautiful to me about it.
If I was to pick, actually, two fields which I think impact most on people, I would probably pick science and art. Mm. Because I think when it comes to me anyway, if I'm walking down the street and there's a sunset going on, I'm actually going to stop and look at it. I walk out at night, I look up, I see all these gorgeous pictures made for me in the sky. I pay attention to things as I walk by, because visually, I'm a real visual person, and I love the aesthetics of things around. I love textures, I love touching things. And science is something, we could not be sitting here in the studio, because without science and engineering, who would have built it? Who would have made the mics work? Who would have set it up so we can broadcast these radio waves out to all of your cars out there driving home from work? It's amazing. And actually, now that I've touched on stars, Lorraine, of course, is an astrophysicist, which means you work with the sky and everything beyond. Mm-hmm. So it's all galaxies and clouds and pulsars and gamma rays. Mm. And from my perspective, looking up is the most aesthetically, visually beautiful thing you can possibly do. And I know Max will agree. Tell me about the kind of stuff, the kind of ideas you have or things that you may have already done to do with art, to do with the sky, to do with the kind of work that Lorraine would do, looking through telescopes at pretty pictures far, far away.
Well, as part of the Gloria project, we've been working together on, well, I suppose I've been thinking, apart from a scientific reason to look out into the universe, how can we feel in relationship to this vast, vast universe? You say, well, here's a telescope, you can look up into the universe, and I think, well, that's great. Which bit will I look at? It's huge. So we developed an idea called personal space, which means it's a tool which with people can work with the telescopes, which will allow us to, if you like, own our own coordinates on Earth. So, for example, we're sitting here in the studio. If we think directly, if we took a line directly from where we're sitting right now, straight up out into the universe, if we have our coordinates, which we can easily get nowadays, thanks more to technology.
Google Earth has them right
there. Earth, there we are. And we have a time and a date, then
you know exactly what it is.
And how to point the telescopes to look at that. So we're looking also back in time as well. We'll now be able to take, for example, the day that I was born. If I had the the coordinates for that, be able to see exactly what the universe looked like above my head.
So it's almost like astrology without the nonsense.
Exactly. We're hoping to make it into a multi-million dollar.
That's our new logo. Yeah. Astrology without the nonsense. Yes, if I had any mission in life, it would be to
eliminate,
get rid of astrology and actually replace it, because the real thing is so much more amazing.
I couldn't agree with you more. It really upsets me that most of our daily papers will have astrology in them, and yet this program, for example, is dedicated to bringing some of the new findings of science and just discussing them and kind of putting them into the general discussion. It upsets me that our newspapers think it is more important to discuss how Taurus is going to be affected by money and romance over the coming week. That to me is such a waste of newspaper ink.
What upsets me is that people believe it.
They don't believe it, but what they do think is, can't hurt just to look at my star sign. And it really, they're full of, is it Barnum statements?
Yeah,
that's the phrase they have from P.T. Barnum, the person who said there was one born every minute, by the way. That you can make general statements that appear to apply to an individual. And I would rather, personally, my favourite programme is Sky at Night with Patrick Moore, still going after 55 years, I think, with his monocle. Yep. But his programme will tell me what I can see in the night sky on any given time, and to go out and to be able to look up with my little 8-inch refracting telescope and look at the face of infinity and pick out points of interest in it, to me, is of an emotional connection with what the universe is that astrology is a parody of.
Yeah, I think that's a good description.
Awful parody. Yeah.
But I think what we liked about the personal space idea was the way when we actually get it onto the website will be that we can connect people's stories. So overlapping pieces of sky and timelines will intersect. And it's a way of connecting and sharing commonalities in you know, your time history, your actual celestial time history, and recording memorable times and dates with images. So we will be able to deliver to people beautiful images of their piece of chunk of sky at a particular time, when their kids were born, when they got married, whatever.
So it's kind of a multi-dimensional interface stretching over time and space and then experiential as well.
So and you're bringing it to a personal, connecting personally.
You're interweaving it, so you can look up what the sky was like when your father was born, wherever he was born.
Exactly. You can take it as far back.
That's absolutely awesome. I love the sound of that.
You're listening to The Redshift Show right here in Dublin South FM. We're going to take some Kings of Leon in a couple of moments. We're here talking to Lorraine Hanlon, who's a physicist from UCD, and Eimear O'Boyle, who's a collaborative artist who's been working very closely with Lorraine. We're going to take some Kings of Leon. I'm not sure if Tony hears me. He does. Oh, cool.
Tell me the one about the friend you knew in the last good night that we toasted to. So one in the matinee and the spotlight show what I chased away. Stay for me. She saw my coma over her hourglass body. She had problems with drinking milk and being school tardy. She'll loan you her toothbrush. She'll bought him your party.
Called in a call, but I can't get through. Said he's on his own, but as on as you. Heal me. She saw my comb over her hourglass body. She had problems with drinking milk and being school tardy. She'll loan you her toothbrush. She'll bartend your party. My comb over her hourglass body. She had problems with drinking milk and being school tardy. She'll loan you her toothbrush. She'll bartend your party.
Grasp the wealth.
Welcome back to Redshift. You're listening to Science and Music right here on 93.9 FM. I'm in studio with Max Krasnovsky, Lorraine Hanlon and Emma Roboyle. And we're going to talk about Gloria. Gloria is a telescope project that's very much something that people, regular people, can get involved in. Can you tell us a bit about that, Lorraine, please?
Yeah, I can. It's a European-funded project, so it involves 14 participating institutions. In fact, all over the world, we have partners in Chile, Russia, Poland, Ireland, Italy,
Czech Republic,
Spain.
Spain has nine, I think.
Yeah, and the UK, University of Oxford. And really, the idea is to take existing telescopes that we have among the members of the network. So, for example, myself and my team in UCD have built a robotic telescope called Watcher, which sits in South Africa. And the partners in Gloria have similar systems around the world. And the goal is to link all of those telescopes together under one umbrella, whereby we give it a kind of collective intelligence. So there will be the possibility to access any telescope in the network for your own research or your own interest. And the system, the telescope network, will decide which telescope should make those observations, because your source is in the southern hemisphere, it has to be ours or the one in Chile, depending on the time of night, and so on. So that's the kind of very basic task. But the next task, and that's almost complete now, so the telescopes existed, and this phase of the project, which started just over a year ago, was to get all those telescopes in a way to be able to communicate together and have a scheduler that can do all this intelligent scheduling. And the next phase will be to develop the interface such that any citizen, kid, adult, amateur astronomer,
you,
professional, telescope hog,
anyone sitting in their car listening to the show on the way home,
you,
it's mine,
will be able to use the telescope. So it really will become a tool for anyone who has an interest in the stars to take an image of, you know, either a planet or a star, a galaxy, a nebula, whatever is their favorite thing. And really, ultimately, the aim is that we will generate a community of people who will actually do all the work, so that it becomes, you know, we hand it over, if you like.
Citizen astronomy.
Really, as a genuine citizen astronomy. I mean, citizen science is very, very important and growing dimension of a lot of research projects. And the team at the University of Oxford, who are part of Gloria, have pioneered Galaxy Zoo, Planet Hunters, Moon.
Done a little bit in that myself.
Fantastic, yeah. And they're really experts at that. All of those we would call offline experiments, to use the Gloria language, meaning that all the data has been collected and then the citizens analyse that data for various purposes. In Gloria, actually, the data are taken by the citizens as well. You decide, I want to make observations of that star for 3 months because I want to see if it changes in time. And the community of users will decide based on a kind of meritocracy. Are you a good citizen? Have you helped other people with their projects? Do you vote in things? Do you answer questions for people? Do you help out and sweep the floor, virtually speaking?
Yes.
And if you do, hey, okay, we'll give you the time.
That's wonderful. And I'm really liking the sound of this.
Yeah. And where do you come into that, Emer?
Well, I come in, I suppose, what I was talking earlier on, ideas around personal space, thinking about how can we engage particularly the non-scientist people who don't come from a science background but who might have interest, and how can we pique that interest, and coming up with ideas about how to engage our the people in the community.
Mm. Communication.
That's it, yeah. Mm. And I'm not doing a very good job there explaining that.
That was perfectly clear to me. So,
you're kind.
Does that mean, for example, then, that your input will inform whatever software is used by the citizen astronomer to access this? Will you be helping to guide that process?
Well, I suppose, yes. If we take again that personal space idea, that the software has to be developed around that, but it'll be very, very user friendly. And the ideas that I'm coming up with anyway will certainly be aimed at the non-professional. So yeah, the amateurs and the generally curious.
Well, I'm willing success for you because I'm going to be hopefully enjoying the fruits of your labours there. These telescopes all work in optical wavelengths. Mm-hmm. Is that right? That's the area of the electromagnetic spectrum. So does that mean if I'm signed up to this and I'm awarded some time in a telescope that I could have an image of the Sombrero Galaxy on my computer then? Really? That's extraordinary. That's got me very excited now. I'm really looking forward to this.
But you know, there is a telescope you can do that with at the moment called the Bradford Robotic Telescope. And that's for free as well. Wow. Gloria will be free and open access. I should emphasise that. There are a few very limited systems available currently. Nothing of the scope of Gloria, but there you pay. And you can pay and you can get images from those telescopes. But the Bradford Telescope team, we've collaborated with quite a lot in the last few months, and their telescope is in Tenerife, which is a really good site. And they have a very, very wonderful web resource for school kids. So we've actually rolled out a pilot program in Irish schools in the last 6 weeks using the Bradford. We've got kids, about 350 school kids signed up to the Bradford, and we've done the lessons with them in Dublin and Wicklow, and then our partners Blackrock Castle Observatory in Cork have done the same in Cork. Nice. So we're really blown away by the feedback we've had from the schools. They're incredibly positive and enthusiastic that this has inspired them, inspired their interest in science, inspired their interest in, for example, taking physics for the Leaving Cert. These were transition year kids. So we really think that there's potential there to do that nationally, funding permitting.
Yes, of course.
But this is, in my view, a kind of pathfinder for Gloria. This is opening the doors, if
Some
you
nice
like,
analogy.
To Gloria. And so then when the Gloria telescopes are available, we can go back to the schools and say, hey, now you can take whatever images you want. It doesn't matter where in the sky they are, because somewhere in Gloria we'll be able to access that sky.
And of course, their grounding with the Bradford telescope will have offered them ideas about what targets they might want to look at.
Yeah.
What is the resolution of these optical? For example, with my little telescope, I can get Jupiter. I can see the tropical bands. Can't quite make out the red spot. It's not quite strong enough to do that. Would these optical telescopes, for example, be able to image the moons of Saturn?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are, like Watcher is a 16-inch reflector, and most of them would be, so that's 40 centimetres diameter mirror, would go from about 40 to 60 centimetres, and we should have even, I think a 90 centimetre is the biggest one in the network planned. So absolutely, these are deep sky imaging telescopes. These are my sciences, as Niamh knows well, is about gamma rays, astronomy, but I use this optical telescope to observe the visible light from gamma ray bursts. So really what we're interested in is a very fast response when a new gamma ray burst happens. But when we're not observing those, then we can observe anything else. So we'll offer a fraction of our observing time for free to Gloria, as will all the other telescopes.
So will this network again be used? I know that when a nova, supernova, or hypernova detected, you want to turn as many instruments as possible onto that correlator. Will Gloria be optimised for that as well?
It'll be, if you propose the experiment to the community and the community wants you to do it, then yeah, absolutely.
So it isn't already designed, say, for example, to interrupt something that's already in progress?
It will be able to respond to transients and alerts, so things like the supernova search campaign, things like the gamma ray bursts,
or a comet if it's going towards Jupiter or the sun or something.
Yes.
You could swing it round onto, well, maybe not the sun if it's optical, but
hopefully we'd have more than a day's notice, but in theory, yes. So any system that sends alerts about new astronomical phenomena, we'll be able to respond to that.
Okay, so it's quite a flexible system then.
Ideally, yes. That's definitely in the design that it will be allowed. You'll be able to do, we also have some solar telescopes, so we'll be able to do daytime astronomy, which is great for school kids. Again, in fact, we'll be able to operate in a mode where people can take direct control of the telescope.
Right, okay.
So most of the time it's all done automatically, but there will be the possibility to so-called teleoperate the telescopes, which would be great in classrooms. rooms, for example, that school kids will be able to open the dome, point the telescope at the sun, get the images of the sun back, and count sunspots, for example.
How exciting.
I did that for the first time there a few weeks back, where I got a filter for my scope. And I remember showing it to a friend of mine and going, what am I looking at here? Because all they could see was going, look at the little dots with the rings around them. They're sunspots. But for me, it was very exciting anyway, but I found it difficult to communicate. I'm just wondering, Eimear, will you be looking at the images yourself that come through Gloria or in this project? And do you think that those images, which I find so emotionally engaging, and you've said that this kind of grandeur of connecting with the universe as well, do you think they'll feed back into the artistic process of yourself and of the other artistic people who are collaborating?
Yeah, well, I'm personally quite interested in how those images are processed and how they're put together. I suppose at the moment there are many, many of those images sort of readily available. I'm kind of interested in this idea of having some sort of a personal connection to a particular area of the universe and those kind of images. So yes, I'll certainly be getting images and working with those kind of images.
But you had that very
myself.
Nice movie you made of when we got a gamma ray burst during the summer that was incredibly bright with within 80 seconds with Watcher. And Eimear made this wonderful short video, and it happened at about 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 7 billion light years away. And so
not in the immediate neighbourhood then, not local.
Don't panic. and she just cut in her son sleeping.
Oh, wow. That's so lovely.
And then with the images from Watcher, and it was so bright and so fast to fade. From image to image, you could see this thing, new thing, appearing and then over the next few minutes disappearing again. So brightening and fading.
From 7 billion light years just, and then a sleeping child adjacent.
That is a juxtaposition.
That is in my head. I'll have to see the images itself, but just the concepts are amazing. Yeah. Because you're talking about one of the most violent events in the entire universe.
See it on this peaceful
and the serenity.
While all of us are asleep.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think that's a perfect illustration of how you integrate the science and the artistic ideas. That's absolutely beautiful.
Is that one of your favourite pieces that you've made, or are there ones that stand out that you really go, yes, that's some of my best stuff?
I happen to think everything I do is wonderful.
Excellent. That's the way to be.
I really like, there was over the period of the transit of Venus as well, it's connected to that idea of so much of this is happening while we are sleeping. And maybe that as a metaphor as well for being caught up so much in day-to-day life and our everyday worries that we forget that we're part of this really magnificent picture
celestial
of life.
Celestial ballet, yes.
Yeah.
One of the projects I particularly liked was... was it June 6th? There was an eclipse. That was the transit, where everybody sent in their pictures that they had taken.
Yeah. Message to the future. That was another idea we came up with to try and engage people in the while you were sleeping ideas. So a lot of people wouldn't get to see the transit of Venus, will never get to see it because the next one's 118 and a half years away. So we asked people just to send us their pictures of whatever it is they were doing that day. Didn't matter what it was, putting the kids to bed. The Olympic torch came to Dublin that day. We've lots of pictures. So we got nearly 500 photos. Now, a lot of people sent us pictures of them looking at the transit. And even that is really interesting because of all the different techniques and places and technologies that were used. I think that's a really lovely project. And we still have a lot of... things to get from that. I think I would love to make time capsules for, you know, children's schools and so on, even for the UCD Science Building, because I have pictures of the construction site on that day. So making an exhibition out of some of the work, using that work in some videos, ideas we've had.
And I think the idea that people in the future scientists who will be watching the transit again, will then also have a record of what was happening. While all of the scientists were looking outwards for images for the transit, looking away from Earth, we had thought about pointing the cameras back onto ourselves. This lovely... dual archive then of the transit itself, and then the reality of life on Earth
It reminds me of Carl Sagan's turning around the Voyager spacecraft to image Earth.
Yeah, while pale blue dot.
The pale blue dot. Yeah, that there's something about that. That who was it who said that the most fitting topic for human study is humankind? I think that knowledge has to push outwards as well as inwards simultaneously. So you're kind of you're illustrating that by chronicling that moment when Venus is. Crosses the orb of the sun. It's very beautiful.
Thank you. And on that, we maybe take a song. You're listening to The Redshift here on Dublin South FM. It's Science and Music. We're with you until 6:30. What are we going to listen to, Tony?
I can't remember. I think it's the Foo Fighters.
Brilliant. Good. That's the way it should be. Welcome back to Redshift. You're listening to 93.9 FM. We're talking science and music. We're talking to Lorraine Hanlon, who's a physicist from the UCD.
So we were just speaking there during the break about your academic background. You did your undergrad and your master's in UCD, and then you travelled to the Netherlands. And where were you based in the Netherlands?
So I worked in ESTEC, which is the European Space Agency Technology Research Centre, and I was there as a fellow for 4 years, just under 4 years, where I worked on one instrument called COMTEL that was part of a NASA great observatory called the Gamma Ray Observatory. So that was in orbit between 91 and 99 and got us really the first flavour of a very detailed all-skies survey of gamma ray bursts, and also produced really the first in-depth survey of very high-energy gamma rays, giga-electron volt range, with an instrument called EGRET. And its successor now is called Fermi, is currently flying by NASA. So
it's a space telescope then, yeah. So your field of expertise are gamma ray bursts. Can you tell us a little bit about what is a gamma ray burst?
Yeah, it's, well, as best we understand them currently, we know from observing them since the late 1960s when they were discovered by chance. There were some number of satellites called the Vela satellites that the Americans were using to monitor Russian violations of the nuclear test ban. So they were looking down towards Earth, and then they kept finding these unexplained transients that seemed to be coming from the deep sky. So they, it turned out, were what we now call gamma ray bursts. So for many decades, we had no clue what they were. They came and went within a number of seconds. They only appeared at gamma ray energies, and you saw one and you never saw it again. They weren't like pulsars with this nice regular heartbeat or anything like that. Very chaotic, short-lived, one-off.
Discovered by an Irish woman. Just have to throw that
pulsars,
in there. Jocelyn Bell Burnell.
Big fan. So it was not till the late 1990s that it became possible, just technically, to follow up the gamma ray bursts with instruments at X-rays and optical wavelengths quickly enough to catch that indeed there was light at other wavelengths, at X-rays, at optical, at radio, which we now call the afterglow, which is kind of like the embers of the explosion as it cools down. And the explosion itself, it appears, is probably, for the most part, coming from a very, very massive star, maybe 40 times our sun's mass or even greater, which essentially collapses inevitably to a black hole. And
is
in that process,
the threshold, 40 solar masses?
No, no, it's not. But it's of more like 8 solar masses for going into collapsing exactly to a neutron star, and then more massive again to go to a black hole. But we think gamma ray bursts are probably even more massive again than what is the typical supernova type energy. And now, some gamma ray bursts have been associated with supernova explosions.
Okay.
But for example, the rate at which gamma ray bursts occur is much lower than the rate at which supernovae occur.
Right. Okay.
So there's typically maybe one supernova per second in the visible universe, and there's probably one gamma ray burst per day in the visible universe.
Okay, so we're talking about many thousands of times
exactly.
more rare.
Exactly, so they're very rare. It would be very rare, as we understand, certainly the early universe, to have these
stars of this size.
This mass, exactly, yeah.
Is it the case, I do remember hearing before, that if a star went hypernova near us enough to produce a gamma ray burst, something within 100 light years, that it would just blow the atmosphere off the Earth?
Yeah, some people have modelled what might happen. I can't remember if it's 100 light years or so, but certainly, it would be extremely rare.
Mm.
So please don't panic again.
Well, I was going to ask you about what the odds were of this, because Betelgeuse is an unstable hypergiant.
That's right,
is that within kind of striking distance of us?
Well, I think, as I say, don't panic. they're in our galaxy. When was the last supernova? Several hundred years ago.
1024, I think, with the Chinese.
Well, I think it was maybe Tycho in 15 something.
Oh,
wasn't
yes,
there
yes,
one more?
Yes,
but anyway, every few hundred years.
Yeah.
So if you think then that that's a supernova, and then a gamma ray burst is a factor of 1,000 times rarer again. And
so
that's
every
only
half
within
a years.
That's only within our galaxy. Mm. Now, some people have hypothesized that maybe one of the mass extinctions could have been triggered by something like
burst.
A gamma ray burst.
Yeah.
And indeed, the models, as you mentioned, would suggest that one in relatively close proximity, and our galaxy is, 100,000 light years, not 100 light years, so it could be far out in the galaxy.
Absolutely.
And not damage us. The other thing is that the emission is beamed in a very narrow cone or jet, so the gamma ray burst has to be pointing right
at
us.
You, like a pulsar's blip.
Beam, yeah, a similar idea.
Is the Earth, or indeed the Sun's magnetic field, any protection at all from gamma rays? Are they deflected?
No, they're not charged particles. So the magnetic field will deflect protons and electrons, but it doesn't necessarily help us. No.
Right, okay.
No, but I mean, as I say, people have attributed some of the one of the mass extinctions to potentially a gamma ray burst. So we would superheat the atmosphere, probably fry the atmosphere. You would probably produce a cascade of particles, and that the gamma ray burst would create things like muons, which could actually penetrate down into the ocean and potentially wipe out marine life as well. You destroy the ozone layer, of course. So all of that lovely, lovely stuff. But actually, about 10 years ago, my colleague Brian McBreen and I decided to take the opposite view. And we constructed a scenario whereby heating of the very early solar system while it was still forming could have caused the creation of these little small inclusions that are found in meteorites called chondrules. That they seem like molten little stones.
Yes.
So we took the view that actually they could have triggered creation of planets.
The genesis might have actually been triggered. But there does seem to be quite a good correlation between evolutionary explosions and extinctions as well. So although a gamma ray burst may have been responsible for one of the mass extinctions, it could also therefore be attributed to the further sophistication and development of multicellular life.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, Kali, I think, the Hindu goddess, was the one that had many arms and many ways of delivering pain. But the fact of the matter is we're all still here despite all of the mass extinctions. What research projects have you got going forward in the gamma ray field?
Well, very luckily we have a lot going on. My colleague Sheila McBreen and myself run the Space Science Group in UCD Physics. We have a team of about a dozen people now on different funded projects. So that's great to have such a team of experts. On the gamma ray side, some of the group are working on Integral, which is a European Space Agency satellite that we have an involvement going back since the mid-90s. It is currently in orbit and approved to stay up there till the end of 2014.
Excellent.
So it's celebrating 10 years in orbit this year.
Yeah.
And that's really the most sensitive gamma ray burst detector up there at the moment. So some of the group are analysing data from Integral, and then I have a project that involves is funded by the European Space Agency and is looking at working with two Irish companies to develop a new type of detector for space, for gamma ray astronomy, but also for planetary emissions where they need to detect gamma rays for planetary spectroscopy and so on. So that it would have a broader application, let me say.
Would that be just for the solar system, or would that be for exoplanets?
That would be, at least in the first instance, would just be for in situ sensing, so or in orbit sensing. Right. Of planets in the solar system. Yeah, we wouldn't be looking at doing that gamma ray spectroscopy remotely.
Right.
From exoplanets yet.
Yes. But further down the line, maybe this could be the test bed for that.
So I think that's a really, really great opportunity for us to engage with companies, which is something that, you know, is important and is great for our students and our postdocs to get that expertise as well. So one of our postdocs has spent some time with one of the companies, and she's now got funding from SFI to develop that work commercially, to take the initial commercialization. So to use these detectors, not now for a space application, but in a medical scenario. So beginning to spin out some of our knowledge of gamma rays from our space work into
bioimaging.
Or even gamma ray treatment, so either a therapy for cancer or diagnosis for cancer diagnosis.
Okay,
so,
I wasn't aware of the medical applications of gamma rays.
So basically, if one gets radiotherapy, you're being treated with photons, I should say, at the mega electron volt range. So bang in our bailiwick, and so taking our knowledge of space detectors and the physics of gamma ray interactions, we're hoping we can leverage that knowledge into medical applications.
That's fascinating. So there's quite a lot of spin-offs from this particular field of research.
Yeah.
Excellent.
You're listening to the Redshift Show right here in Dublin South, 93.9 FM. Now, I'm afraid we are coming very close to the end of the show. So I'm just going to crowbar in Voyager, the spacecraft. It's heading on a journey out, and it's just doing some very interesting things today. Does anybody want to comment on it, or will I'll go for it? Okay.
Bring us up to beat.
Voyager 1 has reached yet another new frontier on its historic journey towards the edge of our solar system. Now, NASA scientists believe that this magnetic highway represents the final region that the Voyager spacecraft has to cross before it becomes the very first man-made object that reaches interstellar space. And they reckon that there's a good chance that Voyager is going to reach interstellar space within the next couple of months. Now, Voyager crossed the termination shock into the outer layer of the heliosphere, which is called the heliosheath, back in 2004. In fact, around now, it was December 2004, so it was a few years ago. And the stream of charged particles from the sun, the solar wind, slowed down from the supersonic speeds that it had been seeing until then and started bouncing around in all sorts of directions, which was a big change. And then in June 2010, when it was about 17 billion kilometres, yes, I'm going to say that again, 17 billion kilometres, that's 10.7 billion billion miles from the sun, the outward speed of the solar wind finally slowed down to pretty much nothing, to zero. And the intensity of the magnetic field began to increase. So Voyager is sensing all this stuff as it changes, as it moves further away from Earth, further away from the sun and towards the interstellar space. I mean, I can't believe we as a species have actually sent an object to space, proper space, outside our solar system. That's just amazing.
Well, the great thing about it is that it should remain in operation, I think, for another 10 years or so, something along those lines. Its power source is still going to be operational. So we're still going to have this farthest outpost of human knowledge relaying information back to us from an ever-increasing distance. It'll be a sad day, actually, when we lose contact with it. Reminds me a little bit of, I don't know whether you've any connection with it, but the Corot planet-finding spacecraft, the French one, its second computer failed there recently, and I think later this month they're going to be trying to restart it. And I always feel a little pang when an instrument that's done such extraordinary work, kind of broadening our field of knowledge.
We had a horrible situation with the Gamma Ray Observatory that I mentioned, that I did my PhD on, one of the instruments, because it was working perfectly, and NASA decided that so it had lost a gyroscope. And it was down to its last, I think it had lost two gyroscopes, in fact. So it was down to its last gyroscope, and it was extremely heavy. It was several tons. And at the time, the Mir space station was going a bit haywire. So it was clear that they were going to have to take some action. And they wanted a test bed satellite to test deorbiting maneuvers, i.e. ditching them into the ocean. And the NASA engineers came up with a way in which they would have been able to operate GRO on zero gyroscopes. So they came up with this amazing technical solution, and everyone was thrilled that, you know, the mission could keep going. And the senior NASA administrator said no, and they ditched it into the Pacific in 1999, and we were all, and it was just at that time.
It's devastating.
Devastating, because it was just the year before that we had detected the first optical afterglows from gamma ray bursts,
goodness.
And BATSE was their all sky gamma ray burst monitor, was delivering the coordinates to Earth, and then we lost BATSE, we lost everything.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's
so
bureaucracy
really heart-rending.
Yes, well, you have a much more direct personal experience of sorrow with the loss of an instrument, especially if it was producing good science. That's very sad, but yes, we still have Voyager, and it's still going to be sending us back information. Everything from the pale blue dot to the end of the solar magnetosheath, it's going to be producing good science for us and pressing new frontiers.
And very soon it'll be giving us new information about what's actually out there, what it's detecting.
Well, all of the things from kind of the particle density of the interstellar medium and the radiation levels. So it's really important information. So I think that's it. We've arrived at the end of the show. It's been a real treat. Thank you so much for coming into studio, Lorraine.
Pleasure.
It was great to have Emer here as well. And I wish your collaboration every success. And
thanks,
I look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Definitely.
And we'll look forward to plenty more science and rock music next week right here on Dublin South FM, 5 o'clock on 93.9.
Thanks for listening.
Apple pie from scratch. You must first invent